Welcome to Jacksonville.radio. We're a family of radio stations serving the Jacksonville and South Georgia areas. As a service to our community, we highlight organizations and events that help make this area the best place in the country to live. Thank you for listening to our North Florida neighborhood.
Hey, and welcome to North Florida neighborhood. I'm Colby. And North Florida neighborhood is all about getting to know our neighbors and hearing what really cool and sweet stuff they're doing with us and for us in our community. And today we're chatting with Bruce Fafard. He's the CEO for the Museum of Science and History. Bruce, thank you so much for joining me.
Colby, it's always a pleasure. Thank you for the invitation, and I look forward to our discussion.
Definitely. And Bruce, I just want to congratulate you because, as I announced, you are now the CEO, and that's just kind of been a recent transition. So I'm super excited for you.
Well, thank you. And I'm full of enthusiasm myself. We really, really having a great time here at the Mosh. And, you know, we just dove right in. I have such an incredible team. I just can't tell you how great the staff is here. Their commitment to our mission and what we're doing, and inspiring joy of lifelong learning, and really they're so engaged in bringing to life science and regional history. It's just awesome.
I love how you always say y'all's little tag, the joy, or bringing joy to lifelong learning. But before we kind of dive into the staff and even your transitional role as CEO, Bruce, give us a background on the Mosh, because you guys are a huge part of the Jacksonville community.
Oh, sure. And, you know, one thing I've got to tell you, and hopefully your listeners will get real excited about this as well, is this year, 2021, is actually our 80th anniversary.
Oh, happy anniversary.
Thank you. Thank you. Some real exciting stuff going on. We were chartered back in 1941, and we're actually in the midst of planning a whole mess of different events, some of them pandemic or COVID friendly, and hopefully later in the year, as we emerge from this pandemic, we will also have opportunities for people to come and celebrate with us. So we've got a whole mess of things going on.
Wow, just hearing those numbers, 1941 is when this came about. So what's the transition been like for the Mosh after 80 years? Like, that's a huge culture shock.
It is. And I mean, we've been integral to this community for that length of time. You know, we were in our first home in 1945. We found our first sort of permanent location. And originally, most people know us as the Jacksonville Children's Museum, because that was our original name. And so we moved here to our current building on the South Bank in 1969. And in the 80s, we changed our name to the Jacksonville Science Museum. And then more recently, the Museum of Science and History. And our goals are, you know, sort of, if you look at our history and the things that we've done, we've always been innovative. We always have been looking to grow, expand our programs, bring in as many constituents from the community as possible. And so now we're looking forward to 2024, hopefully late 2024, when we're going to be able to open up a brand new 130,000 square foot museum on the North Bank, and just expand our reach and our capabilities within that footprint. So we're real excited, not only for the history that we've made, but for the history we're going to make in the future.
And what you were talking about, the phrase, or I guess you guys kind of originally coined it as Mosh 2.0, but you scratched that and now it's Mosh Genesis.
That is correct. Yeah, our original vision, which was announced in 2018, was to sort of renovate this facility, expand it a little bit. And as the Board of Trustees actually started putting some plans together, it became very obvious that that was going to be very, very difficult to do. One of the things that they had to come and wrestle with was the fact that if we did that, we would have to close for 2 years. And that was not practical for us.
Yeah.
And, I mean, there were a number of other decision points. For example, this building. You couldn't build resiliency into the building itself. We have limited expansion capability here because of land constraints. We would give up a lot of parking by adding the building. And so the board sort of went back to the drawing board, looked at what the options were, started evaluating other sites, and made the decision in the middle of 2020 that, okay, we need to build a brand new museum from the ground up, and the North Bank location just has so many benefits that will allow us to focus on what our mission is. And so the decision was made to transition from that MOSH 2.0 concept and to a brand new museum that we're calling it the Genesis Project for MOSH over on the North Bank. So we're gonna be able to build 130,000 square foot museum, which is more than double what we have today. We're gonna be able, as a result of that, bring in larger traveling exhibits that we just don't have the room here to be able to do that. We're also gonna be able to redesign a lot of the visitor experience that we have. And we're focusing on what we call three ecosystems. So we'll have an innovative ecosystem, we'll have a natural ecosystem, and we'll have a cultural ecosystem. And each of those will be interrelated because there's overlapping opportunities there that we're gonna have and be able to present to our visitors. In addition, one of the things that I'm just so excited about for the future of MOSH is to be able to incorporate what is known as maker spaces. See, kids learn by doing, by getting their hands involved. In fact, even adults learn by doing and engaging. And so each of these ecosystems will have opportunities or maker spaces where kids, adults will be able to come in and actually interact with the exhibit, create things. I mean, for example, one of the areas that we're considering is come on in and actually build your own musical instrument.
Oh, wow.
You know that music is it's an important component of our history here in Jacksonville, even ongoing. I mean, we have a lot of activities that are planned every year around different music venues, everything from, you know, the jazz festival through to open air concerts. And so that's important to who we are as Jacksonville, and we're gonna sort of reinforce that by giving someone an opportunity to build a musical instrument of their own choosing. And so that's just one example of what a makerspace is and what we're planning for the future in the new museum. We're so excited around that.
And this is all in the works right now, in the process, with the year 2024 in mind. But Bruce, what can we do and how can we get involved with the MOSH right now?
Great question. So, I mean, we are open Thursday through Sunday currently to the public. We also opened for holidays. For example, this past, more recently for President's Day, we were open, and we're going to look to the future. Any other federal holidays, we usually open up and bring a lot of visitors in. And so we have currently Toytopia, which is just a wonderful exhibit. It chronicles the history of toy making through the decades. And we have everything from 1980s arcade. We come and play Pac-Man, in fact, which is one of the games that I sort of grew up with. We also have a life-size dollhouse. I mean, this thing is huge. You can walk in it and experience the different rooms and a variety of other components to Toytopia, including the world's largest etch-a-sketch. And so you can come and engage with that. Our other exhibits are open. The Science Theater, come on in and experience a science show where you'll actually see hands-on demonstration of different techniques or different science experiments. We've got our planetarium. We also have run a lot of programs after hours. We have what we call cosmic concerts in our planetarium, where we highlight different events or different music bands that with a laser show. We also have our award-winning Currents of Time, which is just a wonderful chronology of the history of Jacksonville. And we also have Atlantic Tales, where you can learn about, you know, the different marine animals that are in our environment, and actually go see some live animals in our natural center. So we've got a lot going on, and we continue to add programming. Check our website, which is www.themosh.org, for our current programming and offerings. You can even buy tickets online, so you don't have to wait when you get here. You can just show your ticket, and we'll let you in to enjoy everything that's going on. So those are just some of the things that we have exciting within the museum currently. But there's a lot more. We're planning right now, for example, summer camps will be in person. We've got a whole team that's working on that right now. Those are going to start the week of June 7th, and they're going to run through August 6th. And camp registration for those should be open up next month. For teens that are looking for volunteer opportunities during the month of February, we open up the opportunity for them to come to our website and register. There is limited capability for us to have teen volunteers, but if you're looking for an opportunity to do that, come on out to our website and check that out. And I mean, I could go on. We've got so many exciting things happening here that we just welcome the public to come and visit us.
And I really appreciate how one of the things that the MOSH stands for is innovation. And you said that from the very beginning, and it's shown true within the past 80 years. But I feel like, especially now, with everything that's been happening, you guys have proven to be innovative through your online and virtual experiences also.
Yeah, we have. In fact, we just this week, we have been running a number of virtual field trips for three different schools. Very well received. So excited to be able to participate with them. The other thing that we're doing for our local schools is that because we are closed to the public Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, we're actually working with schools to come in and sort of do a MOSH takeover during one of those days. That provides a safe environment for their students, their teachers, and their chaperones. And they're able to enjoy, as I said before, they're able to enjoy science demonstrations. They're able to enjoy the planetarium or visit the nature center. And so that's something that we recently started doing, because a lot of schools are looking for opportunities to do something, but they want to be able to do it in a safe environment. And being able to offer them exclusive use of the museum during those 3 days, they're so appreciative of being able to do that. And that's in tandem with a lot of our virtual offerings. We actually have created over 70 virtual programs that you can view in the comfort of your home using a computer. A lot of meetings we know in the business community have gone to an electronic format, either Zoom or some other product. Well, we're there as well. Our whole education group has converted a lot of our content online. Some of that is completely free. Some of it you can go to our website and see. Others we look for when you're engaging a larger group or community, a classroom. Those are instructor-led on our end, and so there's a slight cost associated with that. But yeah, we're being as innovative and as creative as we possibly can to continue honoring our mission here within our Northeast Florida community. And we're just so excited to be able to offer both venues, both in person and virtual.
One thing that I was wondering, but I feel like you've already answered it, Bruce, is how is a MOSH different than a regular museum? But you just answered it with all that you guys do and how active and integrated y'all are to your audience.
You know, we are constantly evaluating and asking ourselves the question on how do our programs, do the things that we bring to the community, how do they fit into our mission? And really, it's about learning. It's about bringing to life the science and regional history. And you really do that by creating programs and activities that are engaging, that draw someone in to look at something differently. I mean, one of the most exciting things for me as being CEO here at MOSH is to go out and walk around through the exhibits and to see literally the faces of joy in the kids that are interacting with our exhibits, and just the total fascination that they have with what we can offer them. To me, that is the ultimate, because what you're seeing is you're seeing them being engaged, you're seeing them learn, and you're seeing them being exposed to things that you're not going to find in another location or another facility in our local community. And so hopefully what we're doing is we're actually encouraging the future engineers, mathematicians, scientists, medical workers, artists. That's what we want to do. We want to inspire them to pursue those kind of STEM or STEAM careers.
And I definitely think you guys are right on track with that inspiration. And again, I have the privilege of chatting with Bruce Fafar, the CEO for the Museum of Science and History. And Bruce, you've just recently become the CEO, and that's taking on a whole new role than where you were at before. And there's a lot to step into and a lot to do. So what are you prioritizing right now?
So really, when I first took the role, one of my top priorities was really aligning our resources with our responsibilities to our guests, our employees, and our community partners. And as you know, being in the midst of a pandemic, you really have to reinvent yourself. You have to think completely differently on how to deliver your services. And we went through a really lengthy exercise, not only to prepare originally for reopening in the middle of the year last year, but also how do we maintain that safe environment? How do we bring the resources that we have to bear on ensuring public safety, visitor safety, staff safety, community safety? And so we've added, quadrupled the number of our sanitation stations throughout the museum. We do require guests and visitors to wear masks during their stay here to protect not only themselves, but also our staff and other guests. As I mentioned earlier, we've added a whole litany of digital programming. We did have our winter camps. We reduced the actual number of attendees in order to make sure that we had social distancing there. And you know, the other priority, the other important thing is the progress and the focus on the Mosh Genesis project and being able to continue the enthusiasm and the momentum that we have with that project to build a new museum for the future of Northeast Florida.
Yeah, so how do you continue that enthusiasm, like you said, when it's 3 years out? I feel like you'd kind of be coasting on fumes for a little bit and not be as engaged and excited because it seems so far away.
Not at all. Not at all. We have had many conversations with community leaders, with business leaders about what our plans are, how we're moving forward. We've made extensive use of the electronic format, Zoom and other products to be able to continue that conversation going forward. We also just recently issued an RFQ to 10 architectural firms that are known internationally for building signature buildings for museums. We've gotten those responses back. We've gone through and we're in the process of reducing that group of 10 down to 3. And most likely within the next 30 to 45 days, we'll be issuing an RFP. That RFP will go out to a select 3 architects to actually start the process of responding to a building design that we are right now. Our timeline, and again, there's a lot of things that come into play, but our timeline is to have a final architect selection done sometime in the summer, the June, July timeframe, and then to be able to actually come public with drawings of what the building will look like in the fall. That's our overall timeline, and we continue to work with the Downtown Investment Authority to actually nail down the land site over in the shipyard in the North Bank. We're very, very close to being able to do that. So keep your ears open and your eyes open for the next couple months. We will have some very exciting news. We continue to receive donations. You know, it's so exciting to be able to sit down with a donor, whether they be a local philanthropist or a business leader, explain our plans, and then have them say, yes, we want to be involved. We want to be known as a supporter of MOSH and make sure that this community resource expands its presence in Northeast Florida and remains here for the next 80, 90, 100 plus years. That's our vision, is MOSH for the next 100 years. And so we're from our fundraising to raise the $85 million, we've hit the 30% mark. Matter of fact, we're a little over that. We're so excited about that. And every week I have several meetings with philanthropy, with philanthropists and business leaders in this community to talk and bring them up to speed on what we're doing and where we're going. And so, and again, the response has been overwhelmingly positive. Even if any of your listeners, because we need everyone involved, either by volunteering to help here at the museum, or even the smallest donation can help. You can go to our website at www.themosh.org. There's a donate button there, and by all means, support us. We, like I said, this is a community project. This is not only one group or one area. This is all of Northeast Florida, all of Jacksonville needs to be engaged in this in order to make MOSH successful for the next 100 years.
And just as someone who's a bystander and in the community, for me, it's so encouraging to hear that you have such a strong backing.
It really is. You know, that was one of the things when I took over that, you know, I wasn't, especially in the middle of the pandemic, wasn't sure, you know, would the business community be receptive? Would the, you know, the philanthropy community, the people that really support the arts and other areas in this community, would they be willing, frankly, to open up their pocketbooks during this time? And it's a resounding yes. It's an overwhelming yes. They have been. They see the vision. They understand where we're going and why it's important to this community. And so that, to me, you are exactly right, Colby. That is so exciting to see the community response and to engage in those conversations as we work through this.
Well, Bruce, tell us again how we can be more involved, even if it's just going to the MOSH. Tell me that website and your hours one more time.
So it's www.themosh.org. We are open to the public Thursday through Sunday. We open up, our first tickets are available at 10 o'clock in the morning, and they run through, at least for Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, they run through 5 p.m., and then on Sunday they run through, that we open up at noon, and they run through 4. And so you can get your ticket online, you can show up and get your ticket here. We welcome you to come and enjoy the museum in a safe environment for you and your family and your friends. In fact, please do bring some friends with you. Expose them to what we have here. We've got a variety of different exhibits. We're looking forward to. I won't sort of announce it yet, but in May we're going to be switching out Toytopia. That runs through the 16th of May. So you have the time is starting to get short on when you can see that exhibit. Come on out and experience it. But then starting later in May, because it takes us about a week to 10 days to switch out one exhibit to the other, we're going to have a brand new exhibit for the summer. We're very, very excited about it. You'll start hearing some things regarding what it might be all about pretty soon. And I can tell you it's definitely going to generate a lot of enthusiasm in our community. I'm actually really looking forward to it as well.
Well, Bruce, thank you so much for all you do and for being such a great neighbor in our neighborhood.
Well, Kobe, it is always a pleasure talking to you, and thank you for the opportunity to share what Mosh is doing today and what Mosh will be doing in the future.
Thank you for listening to Our North Florida Neighborhood. Listen again next week. And if you have an event or organization you'd like highlighted, please contact Colby King at Colby, C-O-L-B-I, at jacksonville.radio.
Hey, everybody, it's Johnny the voiceover guy for SNC Square Roofing. As you all know, time slips away. One day you turn around and that new truck of yours is 10 years old. How old is your roof? 2006 was 15 years ago, and that's about the life expectancy of a roof, especially here in Florida. Call SNC Square Roofing today and let them get up there and inspect that roof. Ask about their in-house financing. Don't let time slip away when it comes to your roof, and don't just call any roofer. Call my roofer, SNC Square Roofing. Roofing with integrity. 524-8621. That's 524-8621.
Panera favorites are hot and ready to serve for dinner. Taste our creamy mac and cheese served in a crispy bread bowl. Or the classic bacon turkey Bravo featuring our signature sauce. How about our new mouth-watering chipotle chicken and bacon flatbread pizza? These and other favorites are waiting for you. Order dinner tonight for delivery or pickup. Only at Panera. Availability and pricing may vary.
Credit Karma Money is a brand new checking account where you can win daily instant karma purchase reimbursements on items up to $5,000. Now, when you make a purchase between June 8th and June 30th, you'll automatically be entered to win $1 million. Visit creditkarma.com/winmoney now to open your free account and start winning instant karma. That's creditkarma.com/winmoney. Instant Karma is sponsored by Credit Karma. No purchase necessary. Exclusions and terms apply. See rule. Banking services provided by MVB Bank, Inc., member FDIC. Maximum balance and transfer limits apply.
The following is made possible by Dad.
Why was the basketball court all wet? Because the players kept dribbling all over it.
The dad joke. Corny, groan-worthy, but also one of the simplest ways to share a moment with your kids.
Why do you have to be careful when it's raining cats and dogs? Because you might step in a poodle.
And kids that spend more time with their dads grow up to be smarter, more successful.
Can I tell you a cat joke? Just kidding.
And with any luck, funnier adults.
Why didn't the skeleton go to the dance? Because he didn't have anybody to go with.
Dad jokes rule. So take a moment to make a moment and give your kid a laugh. It's as easy as going to fatherhood.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
That's really funny.
Welcome to Jacksonville.radio. We're a family of radio stations serving the Jacksonville and South Georgia areas. As a service to our community, we highlight organizations and events that help make this area the best place in the country to live. Thank you for listening to Our North Florida Neighborhood.
Hey, and welcome to North Florida Neighborhood. I'm Colby, and North Florida Neighborhood is all about getting to know our neighbors and hearing what really sweet stuff they're doing with us and for us in our community and in our neighborhood. And today, the neighbor we get to chat with is Joyce Marr, the CEO for the Betty Griffin Center. Joyce, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you, Colby, for reaching out to us. We appreciate that.
Yeah, it's definitely a privilege. And while we just kind of kick things off, can you give us a rundown on who the Betty Griffin Center is?
Well, it was originally established in 1990 by a former victim advocate, Mary Alice Colson, from the St. Johns County Sheriff's Office. And as an advocate, she was really seeing that need for a domestic violence center because there was none in St. Johns County. And if there was a domestic dispute, then, you know, survivors had no place, safe place to go. So her was Mary Alice was the original founder with a group of community members. So, you know that saying that, you know, never underestimate what a group of small group can do for a community?
Yeah.
Well, that's what Mary Alice and her group of committed citizens did, was establish the Betty Griffin Center. And so we are so thankful that she had the foresight to gather people together to establish the Betty Griffin Center, and it's formerly known as the Safety Shelter of St. Johns County. But we use Betty Griffin Center because that was her grandmother's name, and she wanted to honor her grandmother. So that's why we call it the Betty Griffin Center.
And what is y'all's mission? What do you strive to do?
Well, we are a mission that really, it's kind of twofold. One is we want to provide a safe space for survivors of domestic violence, and we're a dual center, so we also offer sexual assault services. So we provide both those services. But the other thing is prevention is key. Mm. Because we know that we have to prevent and help educate the community about domestic violence and sexual assault both. Because these are preventable crimes, but we just need to educate the community on the signs and what to look for and how to support survivors. So it's twofold. It's to provide services, to wraparound services around survivors to make them safe and to really educate the community on how we can go out and prevent these two crimes.
I want to hit on both sides of the fold for your operation, but first I want to talk on if I am in a domestic violence relationship or need out, what does the process look like to get connected with the Betty Griffin Center, and then what happens after I get connected with you?
So it comes two ways. If it's an immediate and you have to call 911, law enforcement will connect you with the Betty Griffin Center. The other way is we have a 24-hour crisis hotline that is available, and you can call that hotline. You'll get a advocate on the other end that will provide you information about our services, but really just to validate your feelings and making sure that you know that you're not alone, that there's other people in the community at Betty Griffin House that's willing to support you. And from there, you know, depending on what the survivor is wanting to do, whether they want to come into shelter, whether they're wanting to access some of our other services, then we'll, you know, that the survivor will make that decision. But if she wants to come or he wants to come into shelter, then, you know, we'll make arrangements for them to come. And then once they do come into shelter, we have a variety of services that we can offer them.
And what are those services?
So, you know, other than just, you know, making sure that you and your children are safe, we do case management. And what that entails is really looking at what does the survivor want to do while they're in shelter. You know, many times survivors are coming into shelter with basically their clothes on their back if they're leaving in a hurry, and we'll, you know, we work with them from that point of, you know, what do they see are their next steps. We do a lot of safety planning. We can connect with, depending on the services that they're wanting to connect with, we have an array of collaboration and partnerships in our community. So, you know, we do case management, we help them look for housing, we have an economic justice program where we can work with survivors rebuilding their credit, helping them budgeting, just giving them overall financial information. We'll look for housing, help them, you know, decide where their housing location needs to be. And in St. John's County, well, all over the nation, housing is a huge issue. And that's a lot of times why survivors may return, because there's no housing affordable or workforce housing available, because many times when they're coming into shelter, they've not worked in a very long time or they've never worked. So, you know, that really is another barrier that they have to overcome, and we work with them on many of these barriers that they may have.
And one thing I wondered in so many instances is why people stay with the abuser. And you're saying, honestly, it's because they don't have money or they don't have anywhere else to go.
Well, that's true. I mean, those are barriers because, you know, abuser are very, it's all about power and control. Mm. And they know how to control someone. And so the best way to do it is through many times through financial power, because then if you don't have any money, you can't leave. You know, if you've got bad credit, you can't find housing. And if you don't have transportation or an auto, you can't work. So, you know, a lot of times those financial barriers are why many times they don't leave. Because they don't feel like that they have the resources or support to do that. And that's one of the reasons why we've added some of our services that we have, like our economic justice program, that really helps survivors, you know, work on their credit, learn about budgeting, how to budget, and then we work with Care Connect and the Continuum of St. John's Continuum of Care to really get out and try to help locate housing that's available. That's something that, you know, somebody that's just starting off again can afford.
Joyce, I just want to reiterate, if you are in an abusive relationship and you think there's no way out because you're being controlled financially and just manipulated, like you said, the Betty Griffin Center offers programs and opportunities to get out of that and then help you get back on your feet.
That's exactly right. I mean, they can call our hotline. That would be the first step to calling our hotline. But, you know, necessarily they don't have to come into shelter.
Mm-hmm.
If they are trying to figure out what they need to do, they can call our hotline. And then we can provide outreach services as well. We have advocates that are available that can work with them in a variety of ways. We also have we have counselors on staff where they can work with them on any of the issues. Many times, you know, people have been so traumatized that they're not sure what their next step's going to be. And so just working with, you know, the survivors with counseling and safety planning and for their children as well will really, you know, help them kind of, you know, learn what are their next steps or, you know, how, what am I going to do to get out of this situation? So just helping them know that they're not crazy, they're not alone, and someone is here to support you. It is really sometimes the first step that somebody can make.
I want to kind of transition and hit on the next fold of the Betty Griffin Center, which is prevention is key. So how do you even begin to prevent abuse?
Well, it's really about educating our young people is what it's about. It's educating, you know, and we have a program. We have two different programs. One where we have a community educator that goes into the high schools that really starts talking to the students about what is a healthy relationship, what does that look like, what is consent, you know. Mm-hmm. And so those are the things that we're educating over a period of time, because one of the things we have discovered is that, you know, you can't go in and talk about a subject one time and it's going to be, everybody's going to learn. So we have a series of classes for about anywhere from 6 to 8 weeks that the students will hear different aspects of healthy relationships, what consent is, what consent's not. And so they'll hear that message over the course of 6 to 8 weeks again. And that's what really will make a difference. You know, we're in like the HOPE classes, which the 9th grade, really where we need to be is in kindergarten.
Mm.
Where we're starting to talk to students about hands are for helping, not for hitting, and work on up until, you know, middle school. So our next agenda items is to start getting into the middle school so that we can start talking about healthy relationships, because by the time they reach high school, many times students are already dating, you know, and so we need to start earlier is where we need to start. Right now, we have another program at St. John's River State College where we're working with students on learning how to intervene if they see something that's inappropriate or dangerous. And so it's kind of like a bystander training. And so we're helping students learn how to become not bystanders, but how to start breaking that cycle of abuse and really changing people's belief systems. And so that's one of the other programs that we have in our colleges.
Yeah, Joyce, touching on that, what should we do if we have a friend who we know is in an abusive relationship, or we kind of think that they are and we're not really sure and we don't want to step on their toes in any way? What do we do as friends or as bystanders?
Well, you know, really just being a support system, mm-hmm. letting them know that you're there and you're not being judgmental. And so that's one of the biggest things is that I'm here for you. I'm not going to judge you. If you need help, let me give you this hotline number to call. You as a friend can call our hotline and talk about the situation. You don't have to give names. You know, that's one of the good things about our crisis hotline is you can call and not give your name at all and get information. And so that may be a way that a friend can get started on, you know, just learning what they can do, what services are available. Because, again, you don't have to come into shelter. We have a full array of services, you know, that could be a first step for someone. And, you know, that could range from counseling to our legal program to our economic justice program, you know, our court advocacy program. Any of our different programs could be a first step for a survivor to take or a friend to take, but mainly just being a support system for that person and letting them know you're not judging them.
Well, again, I have the privilege of chatting with Joyce Mara, CEO for the Betty Griffin Center. And Joyce, we've been able to cover all that y'all do, but one thing I really want to know is what sets you apart from all of these other shelters? What makes the Betty Griffin Center different?
Well, I think one thing is that we are a dual center, so we both have domestic violence and sexual assault services. We have a rape care unit at Flagler Hospital where we can provide forensic exams if someone has been raped, and they can either, if they don't want to call law enforcement, you know, they can still get those services and still not report, but they can call our hotline and we can make sure that they're getting a forensic exam and medical care. So the first step is, you know, if you are a rape victim, we're here. Call our hotline at 904-824-1555, and there'll be someone there to help you. And the other thing is we look at things holistically, and we look at what is it that survivors need that perhaps the community may not offer. And so, like I was saying earlier, we have, you know, different programs. We have a, you know, transitional housing. We've got counseling services that may be different than from some of the other services. We have court advocates in the courthouse and our community education, and we have a child welfare advocate that works within the child welfare system, both with victims and abusers, which is different. It's a pilot project that is a national project that we have someone that works specifically with abusers through the child welfare system to make sure that they're engaging in services and holding them accountable for their behavior. Because we can offer as many services as we want for survivors, but unless we do prevention and we hold that batter accountable for their behavior, things are not going to change.
And really, you guys are what it seems to be, a one-stop shop for all areas and all these different difficulties. And Joyce, are you able to share some success stories that you've noticed? Maybe a mom came in just battered and lost and had no idea what to do, and then you've been able to see her progression?
Sure. I mean, you know, everything we do is confidential. So what I can do is just give you an overview of different it won't be one particular story, but what we see is, so often they'll come into shelter or to our outreach, and I will say literally you can see a physical change within an individual as they come in, because when they come in, they feel like they are broken. And I often say, you know, survivors are beaten down long before they're ever beaten up. And so you can actually see that physical change as they begin to gather strength, they're rested, they begin to trust the system, or they trust individuals. I can't say they trust the system, but they trust the person that they're working with, and you can see that physical change. And so many times what we see is they will, you know, start looking for jobs. They'll start, you know, talking about, you know, maybe looking at different careers. They may think, start talking about going to school again. And actually, they'll get out on their own in a housing. And then what we do is we still trying to work on with them when they're in their own housing. And that's really what we're doing, is some mobile advocacy. So once they get into a home, they still need that support system, and so we're there. And so we've seen women and families be reunited with other family members that, for some reason, they've had a split because of the abuse, and we've watched that family be reunited. We've watched survivors go out and purchase their own home for the mm-hmm. first time, which is so exciting. And we've watched, you know, we've had some join the Army and go out and get a career in the military. And so there's a lot of different successes that we see, but we celebrate every little step along the way. Because as advocates, we know how hard it is to make that change and to work all those barriers, you know, and you have to think about their safety, because when they leave, they're at a 75% greater risk of being harmed or killed. And so if you're told that they're going to kill you, you're still going to worry about that. And so we're constantly doing safety plans with survivors, and but they're still willing to make that step forward to make that change.
You guys
and
are
so we're celebrating that every those steps, every step that they make.
And y'all are really able to bring back the confidence in them, and not just bring it back, but help instill it.
Well, we help them regain it.
Mm.
That's what we're there. We're, you know, as advocates, we're survivors' voices in the community, because so often they don't have a voice. And so that's what we're having to do, is help them regain their confidence and regain that voice so they can speak out.
Well, Joyce, y'all are able to do so much for our community, but what can we do for you? What do you need from us?
Well, you know, monetary donations are extremely important to us. You know, we do have, you know, grants that helps, but it doesn't cover a lot of, you know, many times they don't cover a lot of our expenses. So, you know, we're always looking for monetary donations, but, you know, we've got events coming up. We've got a run coming up in September the 25th. And so if anyone is interested in sponsoring the Run for Peace, we would love to have them reach out and ask about the sponsorship. So that's one way. Look on our website. Look on their website, on our website, and typically we'll have a list of wished items that, you know, we can always use. So it would be extremely important, because that helps as well. And the other thing is talk to your neighbors.
Hmm.
Don't be afraid to talk about domestic violence or sexual assault, because you never know, there may be someone in your neighborhood that has experienced that. And if we start talking about it, we take away the shame that many survivors come in. And so we need to take away that shame. And so we just, if we can talk about it and start saying it's not okay, that's a big step right there. So I would ask the community, you know, if you can't do a monetary donation, go to our website, look at our wish list. That's great. Help sponsor our run, and you know, let's talk about it. Let's take away that shame that so many survivors come into our shelter and feel. So, you know,
are y'all ever in need of volunteers?
We do. We need volunteers at our. We have two thrift stores, so we always need volunteers at our thrift stores. We need volunteers to help us go out into the schools and into the community to do community education. We can use volunteers at our shelter. You have to go through some intensive training to do direct service work. We need volunteers to work in our courts for the court advocacy. So, you know, if you feel a need and want to make a difference in our community, just reach out and call our administrative offices at 904-808-8544 and ask for our volunteer coordinator.
And Joyce, can you give me the best website we can go to just to gather more information?
Sure. Go to www.BettyGriffin.org.
And just as we kind of begin to wrap things up, Joyce, can you put it into perspective, how common is domestic abuse? Because I think often we think, oh, I don't know anyone that's going through that, or I don't need to talk to my neighbors, none of them are going through it. But how common is it actually?
One in four.
Oh my gosh.
One in four.
Yeah.
Everybody knows someone. You may not know it, but you know someone that's been in a domestic violence or sexual assault a victim.
Well, Joyce, one more time, give me the best phone number, both for your hotline and to reach out, and then again, your website.
So our hotline number, it's available 24 hours, 7 days a week at 904-824-1555. Or administrative offices at 904-808-8544. And our website is www.bettygriffincenter.org.
Well, Joyce, thank you so much for being such a sweet neighbor in our neighborhood.
Oh, thank you, Colby, for reaching out. We appreciate it, and we thoroughly enjoy being part of the neighborhood.
Thank you for listening to Our North Florida Neighborhood. Listen again next week, and if you have an event or organization you'd like highlighted, please contact Colby King at Colby, C-O-L-B-I, at jacksonville.radio.